This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Racial and social stereotypes run rampant in the novel The Spook Who Sat by the Door. There's a manipulative politician abusing the system, a misogynistic street gangster with little education, and the main character, an angry black man who thinks violence is the answer to society's problems. Novelist Sam Greenlee used stereotypical characters to connect with readers, but he also used them as tools to convey the reality of the anger that disenfranchised Americans were feeling during the civil rights movement. The book was controversial when it was released in 1969. It quickly gained a cult following and was adapted by Greenlee to film in 1973. Now, The Spook Who Sat by the Door is the subject of a new documentary film called Infiltrating Hollywood. That movie's going to be screened this weekend at the Hayti Heritage Center in Durham. A panel discussion with local scholars follows the film. Two of the participants are my guests on the program this hour. Sheila Smith McCoy is an associate professor of English at North Carolina State University. She's also director of the school's African Cultural Center. And Charlene Register is an associate professor of African and Afro-American Studies at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Her latest book is called African-American Actresses, The Struggle for Visibility, 1900 to 1960. Welcome to both of you. It's great to have you on the program.
Thanks for inviting
Thank
us.
You.
Sheila, can you give us a plot summary of The Spook Who Sat by the Door?
Well, this is a very interesting novel because part of what you said is very true in that he deals with stereotypes and how stereotypes convey racial sentiment in the United States. He does a great job, though, of kind of figuring out why that is. So we have a senator who decides that in order to increase his so-called Negro vote, he will insist that the CIA have at least one black officer. And so begins a series of masks that our protagonist, Dan Freeman, assumes, not only to be the right person and convey the right thing in his training so that he can then get additional training and open those doors. And then he assumes a second mask when he leaves that agency to become a social worker working with street gangs. And he ends up teaching them guerrilla warfare tactics and other things so that he can use these street gangsters, if you will, to protect and the community, but also provide armed resistance against the issues related to the white overstructure in Chicago.
And you see his tensions that he's struggling with all the way through. He's part of a pool of African-American candidates who've been brought in. CIA officials are sure that none of them are going to survive. Freeman is determined to do that, but he also has to fight a certain amount of tension among the group that he's a part of, because they're asking for a kind of solidarity that he knows is also destructive.
Yes, that's true. So on the one hand, the middle-class men with whom he's engaged in the training program want him to belong to them in a certain way, to have the same fraternal connections, to be connected with them socially and at that rank of middle class. But one of the interesting things about Freeman is he was born in an impoverished circumstance and went to a historically white college to be educated and was not an athlete. So he is the counter conversation to what's going on not only with the black men who were in this program with him, but with the whites who assume that as an athlete, he had to have been an athlete. He can't both be academically gifted and physically gifted.
And much to their surprise, he finally makes it and he does graduate.
That concludes our oral examination. And let me congratulate you on being the first Negro officer in the Central Intelligence Agency.
So, Charlene, tell us some more about this character, Dan Freeman. He graduates. The character as a type, in terms of who the American public would be seeing on the screen or reading about, the film came out in 73. Was this a revelation? Was this a new kind of black character that was on the screen?
I think it was to some extent because he was very much a revolutionary, but he was almost, to some extent, masked himself as kind of a mainstream American or mainstream black American. And he almost became a kind of vehicle of the black middle class, at least in terms of his appearance and demeanor. Yet at the same time, in terms of his ideology, he was very much a revolutionary.
And it wasn't all talk. As the film and the book progress, I mean, he is involved in hardcore training in guerrilla tactics that are meant to overthrow, to take over cities. There's nothing just simply ideological about it. So to think about that, again, in a character who is obviously or apparently middle class, because remember, you don't even get to the first cut if you have had any kind of ties with militants to begin with, and then see his militants take shape this way also had to be shocking. It would seem to me the American public saw militants as sort of, you know, of a piece and homegrown and couldn't possibly be talking or looking the way Freeman does.
I think that's what makes the film so powerful, is the way that he camouflages himself and the fact that he clearly is not what they are expecting or what they perceive him to be. And I think that's the power of his character and of the film as well.
And you have to define the American public. Who was the American public? Who were the readers and audience, not only of the book, but of the film? Because in many respects, the black nationalist agenda that was out to get racial rights, these were perceived as heroes instead of people who were problematic.
There's, as we get deeper into the plot, you know, we find out about Sam Greenlee and his intentions. Tell us a little bit more about Sam and why he wrote this book.
Well, he was born in 1930 in Chicago, and like Freeman, his protagonist, he was educated at a white university. And he was in a middle-class situation in Chicago, was very much aligned with people who were active in terms of movement, in terms of positive movement. He joined the armed services, and when he went to his first boot camp, he was greeted by a sign that indicated, "Welcome to this Dixie unit," with an American flag and also the Confederate flag hanging. And as he says in the film, so begins his first brush with racist Southern politics. He ends up having a wonderful career, traveling not only out of this country, but in serving in Baghdad and other places. But he wrote this book in Greece at the end of his service in the U.S. intelligence agency. So I think that also adds another level to looking at how the novel, like the writers of the Harlem Renaissance and like the writers of the Jazz Age, to be away from this country and to be able to see it in a different light when one is out of the environs of the country.
And he was a member of the intelligence community? Were the predecessor to the CIA? Was he in the OSS?
He was in the U.S. intelligence agency. And Freeman was one of the first black officers who were educated in that way. So I think he served from 1959 to 65 in the U.S. intelligence agency.
And it's interesting, Charlene, because we're seeing also a spate of films by former intelligence officers, but mostly in the form of James Bond and Secret Agent, right? These ex-intelligence officers trying to somehow come to grips with the new landscape of the Cold War. And here's another intelligence officer highlighting another deeply social circumstance in American culture. Was the film, in a sense, how was it received? And how was the book received when they were published? Because they certainly didn't, you know, look like James Bond in terms of the reception.
I can speak to the film. The film apparently was fairly well received until they pulled the film from theaters. And I think I saw a report where it grossed like $100,000 in the first week of exhibition. And it was released by United Artists. But because of the pressure allegedly applied by the FBI, the film was forced to be withdrawn from the theaters. So that curtailed the kind of money that it could generate, as well as the sort of word of mouth circulation in terms of people responding to the film. But a lot of people, of course, embraced the film, at least within the African-American community, because the film on some level did provide an alternative means or voice by which to respond to the exploitation and oppression that they had endured.
What was the response to the censorship?
I'm not sure. As much as I know is that once the film was pulled from the theaters, you know, there was only word of mouth in terms of having access to it. And I do know, I think I read that maybe 40 prints of the film were made, but only one currently survives, and it's locked up, at least the negative is locked up in a vault somewhere. So it was definitely taken out of circulation. So I guess it remained alive to some extent on the basis of the novel.
Well, and the good news is you can still see it in its entirety on YouTube if you choose to see it. Sheila, this is also kind of a threshold moment, both 69 when the book comes out, 73 when the film, in terms of the civil rights movement.
Indeed. And in fact, the novel is set in 1965, the year Malcolm X was assassinated, the year of so many violent turmoils in our country. My book, When Whites Riot, deals with the idea of how race riots are seen as black and brown people just being in disarray for no apparent reason. But one of the wonderful things about this book is that it does give the anatomy of a race riot. There's a precipitating event not done by members of the community, but what we actually see is the aftermath of a white riot rather than a black riot. So it's very important to think about him publishing the book and making the film during those turbulent times. Also, it was published first in 1969 by a British publisher, Allison and Busby. He could not find a U.S. publisher until it became well-read and spoken about in England, much like the experience of Frederick Douglass or even farther back, the experiences of many black writers who were involved in agitation, and Phyllis Wheatley first published in England. So I think he's a part of a long conversation of black people who want to present a different view of how America actually operates, who first had to be published in Britain and then tell their story here.
And it's not hard to imagine a film that is somehow captured the flow of race riots being acceptable to the American public in general and not pulled from theaters. But it strikes me that the two frightening things about this is the level of organization. Mm-hmm. They're not spontaneous outbursts. Mm-hmm. This is a real act of coordination and thought, pre-thought, premeditation. But the other thing is the CIA's involvement. These are precisely the tactics that we're using around the world mm-hmm. to extend our imperial power.
Clearly.
And the first example of blowback, I think, in the cinema, which we've sadly come to learn too much about in recent years.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's really ironic that Sam Greenlee, who was a part of the U.S., one of these first officers who were in the U.S. Information Service, himself was impacted by what COINTELPRO did. Being under FBI investigation, mm-hmm. not only sort of silenced the film and really killed the film in terms of being able to show it to wide audiences, but also infected his life being under surveillance during that period of time.
It shows the impact. What impact did it have? Did he continue to write, and were there other films?
He did continue to write. In fact, he's currently writing, though we found out yesterday that he had been hospitalized. So I would ask the listeners to really send out positive energies to Mr. Greenlee, who's in his 80s at this time. He published a book, Baghdad Blues, in 1976, not to the same fanfare that The Spook had, because The Spook actually became a cult classic amongst people who were aware of the racial situation and how we needed to address it in some way.
The book was there any way, I would think in the 70s, very difficult to get any kind of screening of the film.
True.
If it had been pulled from theaters. Mm-hmm. And then later it came back, and as I said, you can get it on YouTube. So maybe you can read from the book for us. Freeman, like all good intelligence agents, is able to operate really in any setting and craft his persona based on the situation. That's how he got into the CIA, and now he has to operate in the streets. So Sheila, would you read a passage from the novel that might illustrate that?
I will. And part of, again, he focuses on stereotypes, so this passage speaks to that. He would be expected to own a car a bit outside of his means, a bit more expensive and flashy than those of his peers at the agency. It was not difficult to conform to the image whites desired, since they did most of the work. They saw in most Negroes exactly what they wanted to see. And clearly what Greenlee is saying is that there's a participatory paradigm here in terms of how the stereotype becomes realized and replicated. And he was really playing with that, not only as author, but also Freeman as character.
Charlene, tell us about the title, the significance of that.
Clearly, I think he was, in terms of the spooks and what that meant, that was a derogatory term, but he also kind of inverts the meaning of it and makes it revolutionary. And, of course, the spook who sat by the door was to refer to or implicate his role, I guess, in the CIA. And I think that was, you know, sort of the significance of the title. But I wanted to add what I thought was interesting. There's a contemporary work by Philip Roth called The Human Stain. And in that particular novel, it's about a black character who masquerades as white, or Jewish, I should say. But anyway, this particular man is a professor, and he loses his job because he uses the term spooks. So I thought that it could have been a play on Sam Greenlee's earlier work to suggest that this man is the exact opposite of spooks, and because he is in denial about his identity, perhaps he should be more revolutionary, as implicated by the term that Greenlee introduced when he wrote the book, The Spook Who Sat by the Door.
And what about the use of stereotype? It seems to me he walks a fine line here in trying to reflect its impact, and yet knows that he can be guilty, be called guilty of promoting those very stereotypes in his work.
And he promoted it to an agenda that became clear as we read through the novel so that he could have this access. He promoted this very agenda. And I think one of the, I'd like to read another passage if you wouldn't mind, because one of the things that he has access to as a perceived insider is that the whites he encounters, from the senators, the president, to other people, that a general actually share with him their racist views as if he also conforms to those. So this one comes from page 63, and this is the general who's talking to them. And he says, "In the fields of sports and entertainment, you are unsurpassed. But you must admit there's still a social and cultural gap to be closed. The African did develop centuries later than the European, you know. It's not a question of prejudice, but one of evolution." So he's speaking to Freeman, clearly not understanding human history or the fact that we all come from the same space in Africa, but clearly expecting him to sign on to these issues. And he signs on because he is there as a representative of the establishment. But this becomes the precipitating moment when he leaves the agency to then go do his field work undercover as a social worker, where he has another identity that becomes a mask.
And there's another scene in the book where there's still a larger group of candidates being trained, and they're sort of going through their paces, being asked, "What would you say here?" What, and in one situation, okay, you're in a foreign embassy, and someone asks you about racism in the United States. What do you say? And the African American candidate says, "Well, we understand that there are certain problems, and they're going to have to be. But in the United States, you know, we're doing things better than you are in your country."
Mm-hmm, precisely.
To be taught the lesson, here's your speech. If you want to wear that suit, you need to make this speech. Mm-hmm. And I think it was sort of brilliantly rendered in the film. But also the conflict, some of the more difficult challenges and choices that African Americans had to make as that movement became more militant, as the nationalist movement went on. There's a scene where Chicago police are trying to break up crowds threatening to riot in the city's predominantly black neighborhoods. Dawson is a black police officer. He doesn't like the fact that these militants now have taken the street. Let's listen.
"Get those dogs out of here! The captain sent me up here. I'm telling you to get them out. I'm in charge. And you know what these people feel about dogs? And I got them on it. Just move them. Or kill them."
I mean, Sam Greenlee is not afraid to take on the tensions within black communities mm-hmm. at the time as well, and reflect those. How were they received? Was that a topic of conversation? Clearly, this is about racism in America and the oppressive white culture, but there was this other conversation that could be had out of his books. Was it going on?
I'm sure it was. And when you think about Dawson, he's a black police officer who, in the scene in the riot, does not want things to precipitate to the next step. They're hoping to hold it down. But as a white police officer who brings in the dogs, who become representative of so much in terms of dogs being used to really try to kill civil rights workers, no matter the race, but they were trained to that. And so the dogs became symbolic of that. But it also speaks to a larger issue, not just in the U.S., but also how police officers, though, when race is involved, may be called upon to do things to their own community members that they would not want to do. But in order, again, to remain in this power structure, they must do their duty.
Yeah, it gets back to that training scene. Mm-hmm. Learn the speech and you can wear the uniform. Mm-hmm. Charlene, now that we do have better access to the film, how well do we know this film? Is it becoming more widely distributed and well-known?
I guess that it is, because I didn't realize it was even available on DVD until, you know, we were invited to this program tomorrow. But I think that it's definitely has a kind of cult following. So people from that particular generation are probably passing it on to other groups. Also, I think the fact that he organized this, the group of what we would characterize in contemporary times as gangsters, the Cobras, some people say that it was a play on what is now known as the Crips. So it's very potentially possible that there is this kind of cult following in terms of linking the past with the present.
I want to thank both of you for being on the program today, Charlene Register and Sheila Smith-McCoy. Thanks for being on the program.
Thank you, Sam.
Thank you.
Sheila Smith-McCoy, an associate professor in the Department of English at North Carolina State, also director of the school's African American Cultural Center and author of When Whites Riot, Writing Race and Violence in America in American and South African Cultures. Charlene Register is an associate professor of African and Afro-American American Studies at UNC Chapel Hill. Her latest book is African American Actresses, The Struggle for Visibility, 1900 to 1960. Tomorrow they're going to be part of a panel, Haytai Heritage Center in Durham. The panel's going to talk about the literary legacy of The Spook Who Sat by the Door and the 1973 film as well. It starts at 5 o'clock. You can look at haytai.org for more. It's haytai.org to find out more. It's Friday. Live music is ahead. Shauna Tucker's back from Las Vegas and live on the State of Things. Stay with us.